You ever thought to yourself, man, what a coincidence? You know, a couple weeks ago, my family and I took a trip to Wisconsin Dells to spend some time with Steph's side of the family. And Amber got us reservations at a resort up there and tickets to a theme park and all this kind of stuff. And it was great. It was going to be fun. It was going to be just us family. And we get up there, and as we're on our way up, lo and behold, some of their good friends from their church family also were going to the Wisconsin Dells. Also had tickets to the same theme parks. Also were staying in the exact same resort that we were staying in, and were going to be there the same days that we were going to be there. I thought, well, what a coincidence. What a happy coincidence, actually, because now not only did we get to spend time with family, we also got to spend some time with some of our spiritual family from other places. And so that was a very neat thing. And you probably have some similar circumstances in your life. You know, something has happened where you bumped into somebody or things just kind of fell into place and you thought to yourself, what a happy coincidence. Or was it? Was it a coincidence? You know, sometimes when we read about the great demonstrations of God's power and his kind of physical manifestations of his presence in the Old Testament and in the Bible, we might begin to think, as we're looking at the mighty miracles that were performed and people being raised from the dead and, you know, different things like that where the power of God is clearly present, and we might begin to feel a little bit shortchanged. Like, man, I wish I had lived back in that time and I could have seen the mighty power of God at work in the lives of those around me and even in my life. I mean, why don't we get to live in a time when God mightily works in the world around us in a way that we can clearly see? Well, let me tell you something. We do. God is still working and working mightily in and around us today. It may not be as flashy of a manner or one that is as clearly discernible as in the days of the past, but make no mistake, he is still working. It may be behind the scenes, but he is working nevertheless in our world and in our lives today. We sometimes describe this as God working providentially in our lives or in the world around us. More formally, that concept is referred to as God's divine providence. And that's what I want to focus us in on just a little bit this morning as we think about our God and focus in on one of his attributes, and that is his divine providence. Well, what exactly is divine providence? I found this quote online that was helpful to me. Somebody said that divine providence is the governance of God by which he, with wisdom and love, cares for and directs all things in the universe. I like that idea. When you look up the word providence or provident, the adjective in the dictionary, it's the idea of making provisions for the future. And so it's describing this kind of planning process when we think about divine providence, God's plan for his creation, and the fact that he is laying things out and he's giving guidance to those things. Another person described it this way, saying that divine providence is God conceived as the power sustaining and guiding human destiny. And of course, that is consistent with Scripture, right? I think about the passage in Colossians chapter 1, verses 16 and 17, where there the Apostle Paul, as he's talking about Jesus, he says that by him all things were created, both in the heavens and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities, all things have been created through him, and notice this, and for him. He is before all things, and this is the important part I want to draw our attention to in verse 17, and in him all things hold together. You see, God not only created the world, but he sustains the world. And even when we think about our own selves as human beings, we have breath each and every day only because God holds everything together and causes it all to work out. He gave us life and he sustains our life each and every day. It is true, as Jesus described, that God causes the sun to rise on the just and the unjust. He sends the rains to water the ground on those who are following Him and those who aren't. He is taking care of His creation. God is the one that Scripture portrays as He who establishes kingdoms and sets men on thrones. He's also the one who deposes them and tears kingdoms down. Jesus would say something like, He gives is opposed to the proud, but He gives grace to the humble. He lifts up and He also tears down. He is in control of things. He is sovereign over all creation. We remember when Jesus talked to His disciples after His resurrection, at least in Matthew's account. In Matthew chapter 28, 18, one of the first things He says to them is that all authority has been given to me in heaven and on earth. That means if all authority belongs to Christ, nobody else has any authority. He's got it all in, notice, heaven and on earth. God is not just some distant God who dwells in heaven and cares not about what happens on this planet with His creation. He is ruling over all of it. And that means when Jesus says all authority in heaven and on earth has been given to Him, it means that He is in control of all things, and what He desires will come to pass. And somebody says, well, hold on a second. What about free will? Isn't that a violation of free will? Don't we have some choice in this as well? Yes, we do. When we think about free will, we're talking about the ability of man to choose for himself what actions or plans that he's going to make or take. And all men can choose one of two things, essentially, when it boils down to it. We can choose either to submit ourselves to do things God's way in keeping with His plans and His purpose, in which case there will be success, or we can choose to do things our own way, oftentimes those being in direct opposition to God's plan and purpose, which will lead to destruction. But notwithstanding this concept of free will and that we can choose for ourselves our own destiny, it does mean that ultimately God's will is going to be done. His will be accomplished no matter what. We can take our stand against Him, but that's not a very favorable place to stay. I like this counsel that Gamaliel gives to the Jews early on in the book of Acts. This is after they've already warned the apostles, stop preaching about Jesus. Stop talking about the resurrection. Stop implicating us in the crucifixion of this guy. Just shut up about it. And the apostles keep preaching Jesus. And so they drag them back before them again. They're like, didn't we tell you to knock it off? And Peter says, you know, we got to listen to God rather than man. And notice the response of the council at this time in Acts chapter 5 and verse 33. When they heard this, they were cut to the quick and intended to kill them. But a Pharisee named Gamaliel, a teacher of the law respected by all the people, he stood up in the council and gave orders to put the men outside for a short time. And now that it's just the council gathered around, he said to them, men of Israel, take care what you propose to do with these men. For some time ago, Theudas rose up claiming to be somebody, and a group of about 400 men joined up with him. But he was killed, and all who followed him were dispersed and came to nothing. After this man, Judas of Galilee rose up in the days of the census and drew away some people after him. He too perished, and all those who followed him were scattered. So in the present case, I say, stay away from these men and let them alone. For if this plan or action is of man, it will be overthrown. But if it is of God, you will not be able to overthrow them, or else you may even be found fighting against God. And of course, they take his advice and they kind of back off the apostles just a little bit for a time. You don't want to be found fighting against God. You want to be on his side, because ultimately his plans and his purposes are going to be accomplished. God is still working that way providentially today. It's not always as obvious or in your face that God is the one who's doing it. You know, it's not always that fire comes down from heaven and consumes the sacrifice, like when Elijah built the sacrifice on top of Mount Carmel, right, and covered it with water, and the fire came down and consumed the whole thing. It's not like when Aaron and the priests offered the first sacrifices after the tabernacle was built and fire came from the Lord and consumed their sacrifice, showing that he approved of what they were doing. It's also not like when the fire came from the same place and consumed Nadab and Abihu for not doing what God had commanded them to do. It's not always like in the days of Korah's rebellion that the earth opens up and swallows a whole bunch of people who are rejecting God. It's not always flashy like that. Many times, oftentimes, it's God working behind the scenes to bring about his plans and his purposes. And you know, something I want us to understand is that that's not just like something for this dispensation. It's not just for these last days that God works providentially. It's not just under the new covenant. God has always worked providentially behind the scenes. Go all the way back to the book of Genesis. Think about Joseph for a second. Hated and despised by his brothers. They plotted his murder, but then decided to sell him as a slave to Egypt, where he experiences a meteoric rise in the house of Potiphar, just to be thrown into prison later on under false allegations, where he interprets dreams and then is forgotten about, and then finally called out to interpret Pharaoh's dream and is elevated to the second position in Egypt, making preparations for this huge famine and thus providing salvation for his very brothers who hated and despised him. And Joseph said to them in the end, "You meant it for harm, but God intended it for good." God's working behind the scenes. You know, in the days of Jonah and his ministry, or maybe his attempts to not have a ministry, you know, he go to Nineveh and preach repentance there. And Jonah says, "No, I don't want to do that." And so he gets on a boat and flees to Tarshish. And what happens? This great storm erupts and the boat can't make any progress. And Jonah's like, "Guys, it's me. You know, I'm the problem. Throw me overboard." And as soon as they do, the storm stops. And a great fish swallows Jonah. And he's in that fish for 3 days and three nights praying to God. And then the fish vomits him up on the sea. And Jonah finally goes and does what God instructed him to do. It wasn't chance that the storm broke out. It wasn't chance that a big fish swallowed him. That was God working behind the scenes. Even in the life of Paul, you think about his last trip in the book of Acts as a prisoner to Rome. He suffers a shipwreck, but they crash land on the island of Malta, and it gives Paul an opportunity to preach the gospel there, even as a prisoner to a people that he otherwise would have never come in contact with. And even when he's in Rome for 2 years in his own rented quarters, he's preaching the gospel without any hindrance, to such an extent that he's able to preach the gospel to those in Caesar's household, and they are converted to Christ. And Paul would tell the Philippians, you know, "Don't worry about the fact that I'm in prison. It's turned out for the furtherance of the gospel." That was God working providentially behind the scenes. This morning, though, I want to look at an account a little bit more in depth from the book of Esther. It's really the account of Esther and Mordecai. And the reason why I like this one so much in regards to the providence of God is because as you read through the book of Esther, there is one character who is conspicuously absent. Do you realize that the only book of the Bible that does not refer to God is the book of Esther? And yet, as we will hopefully see, God, though unmentioned and unseen or acknowledged in the narrative, is nonetheless working in the background, providentially guiding events and bringing about his plans and his purposes. So if you would, go in your Bibles to Esther. Our story begins really in the year 479 BC when Xerxes, or your Bible may refer to him as Ahasuerus, the great king of kings, ruler of the massive Persian Empire, suffered a major defeat in his efforts of European expansion. It was on the Grecian peninsula that his superior military force was overwhelmed and ultimately repulsed by an inferior but united Greek army in the fields of Plataea. And the final victory of the Greeks essentially wiped the Persians out of their land for good. Never again would the Persians set foot in Europe. Now, with this news of this crushing defeat, Xerxes retired from his military headquarters back to his capital in Susa in Persia, no doubt disheartened at this crushing failure. And upon returning home, the king, sad, forlorn, began looking for a new bride, a new queen to replace the one that he had banished nearly 4 years prior. And so he began gathering up all of the eligible maidens throughout the land, all the prospective brides. And at that time, wouldn't you know it, it just so happened that there was at the citadel of Susa a Jew whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite, who had been taken into exile from Jerusalem with the captives who had been exiled with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had exiled. And he was bringing up Hadassah, that is, Esther, his uncle's daughter, for she had no father or mother. Now the young lady was beautiful of form and face. And when her father and mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. And this beautiful maiden is plucked out from the populace and transferred to the harem of King Xerxes, where she will undergo a procedure of preparation to gain an audience with the king to see if he likes her and will become the queen. And understand, there was probably hundreds of young women who were auditioning for this position. But when it was Esther's turn to come into the presence of the king, it just so happened that the king loved Esther more than all the women, and she found favor and kindness with him more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Then the king gave a great banquet, Esther's banquet, for all his princes and servants. He also made a holiday for the provinces and gave gifts according to the king's bounty. And as a result of Esther being crowned the new queen of Persia, her uncle, cousin, father figure, Mordecai, somehow manages to get himself a position sitting in the gates of the city. And this was not just a position of loafing about and enjoying the day. The gates of the city was where the elders, where the wise men, where the judges would sit. When there was a case that wasn't worthy to be brought before the king, it was these elders who sat in the gate that would judge between people and pass out decrees. And so this is a pretty important position that Mordecai has secured here, probably through some strings being pulled by Esther as the new queen. But in this position, it just so happened that while Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, Bigthan and Teresh, two of the king's officials from those who guarded the door, became angry and sought to lay hands on King Xerxes. But the plot became known to Mordecai. And he told Queen Esther, and Esther informed the king in Mordecai's name. And when the plot was investigated and found to be so, these two guys were both hanged on the gallows. And it was written in the book of the Chronicles in the king's presence. After these things, probably about 5 years later, 474 BC, we're introduced to another figure in the narrative, a guy by the name of Haman. Haman is the son of Hammedatha, an Agagite, and he is promoted to this very high and exalted position over all the princes in Persia. And as part of his position, King Xerxes issued an order that all people should bow down and pay homage to Haman whenever they cross paths with him. And everybody did that, except for one man. Mordecai would not stoop down and bow to Haman. And that absolutely infuriated Haman. He was so upset that he determined, not only am I going to rid myself of this pestilent Mordecai, I'm going to annihilate all of his people. And so, through a little bit of deception and political savvy, Haman secures authority and a written edict in the name of King Xerxes to have all the Jews throughout the entire empire destroyed on a specific day in the near future. And when Mordecai learns this news, he is understandably distraught. And he instructs Esther, who is the queen of Persia, to intercede on behalf of her people, the Jews. The only problem with that is that an attempt to do so could put her life in jeopardy. She tells her uncle Mordecai, all the king's servants and the people of the king's province know that for any man or woman who comes to the king, to the inner court, who is not summoned, he has but one law, that he be put to death, unless the king holds out to him the golden scepter so that he may live. And here's the problem. I've not been summoned to come to the king for these 30 days. And this hesitation on the behalf of Esther is met with the following response by Mordecai. He says, "Do not imagine that you in the king's palace can escape any more than all the Jews. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place, and you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not attained royalty for such a time as this?" And so, at her uncle's urging, she makes the bold attempt. In chapter 5 and verse 1, it says, "Now it came about on the third day that Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the king's palace in front of the king's rooms. And the king was sitting on his royal throne in the throne room opposite the entrance of the palace." And at this moment, Esther's life hangs in the balance. But it just so happens that when the king saw Esther the queen standing in the court, she obtained favor in his sight. And the king extended to Esther the golden scepter which was in his hand. And so Esther came near and touched the top of the scepter. And the king said to her, "What is troubling you, Queen Esther? And what is your request? Even to half the kingdom it shall be given to you." And so Esther says, "You know, husband, king, what I'd like is, I'll tell you what my request is, but I want you and I want Haman to come to a special banquet today that I'm going to throw." And so the king says, "Absolutely." And Haman is summoned immediately, and he and the king go to this banquet that Esther has put on for them. And Haman seems to just be tickled pink about this. I mean, what an honor to gain a private... I'm the only one invited to go have lunch with the king and queen. I must be pretty special. I must be pretty important. And while they're at the banquet, the king again asks her, "You know, what is it exactly that you want?" And she says, "I tell you what, I will tell you tomorrow, but I've got an even more important banquet that I want to throw tomorrow for you and Haman. So you guys come back tomorrow, and I'll tell you then, I promise." And Haman leaves there, and he is floating on cloud nine. But it just so happened that as he was leaving, Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gates, that he did not stand up or tremble before him. And Haman was filled with anger against Mordecai. And so Haman rushes home to seek the counsel of his wife and his closest friends. And they advise him to construct a gallows, a huge gallows, and the next morning to ask the king if he can hang Mordecai on it. So that way he'll be able to go to this really special banquet with the king and queen, unbothered or perturbed by this pestilent enemy. Haman says, "That's a good idea." And he gets to work right away building the gallows. And I kind of get the impression that he's maybe building it into the night, making sure that it's all ready. And as soon as it's ready, he's going to go ask for permission. But meanwhile, that night, it just so happened that the king could not sleep. And so he gave orders to bring the book of records, the chronicles, and they were read before the king. And it just so happened that it was found written what Mordecai had reported concerning Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs who were doorkeepers, that they had sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. And it just so happened that the king said, "What honor or dignity was bestowed on Mordecai for this?" And it just so happened that no such honor had been bestowed upon him. And so the servant says, "Nothing has been done. Well, this cannot stand. This must be rectified immediately. But who is available to consult to figure out what kind of honor would be worthy of this kind of a man? And who could carry out this honor for him? Who is available?" Well, it just so happened that Haman had just entered the court of the king's palace in order to speak to the king about hanging Mordecai on the gallows which he had prepared for him. And the king's servant said to him, "Behold, Haman is standing in the court." And the king said, "Let him in." And so Haman came in, and the king said to him, "What is to be done for the man whom the king desires to honor?" And you'll notice Haman's inner dialogue. "Whom could the king desire to honor more than me?" And so I tell you what, he comes up with a real doozy. He comes up with a real good one. He says to the king, "Oh, for the man whom the king desires to honor, let him bring out a royal robe which the king has worn, And let a horse on which the king has ridden and on whose head a royal crown has been placed, and let the robe and the horse be handed over to the king's most noble princes, and let them array the man whom the king desires to honor and lead him on horseback through the city square and proclaim before him, thus it shall be done to the man whom the king desires to honor. All the while, as Haman is laying out this great, magnificent honor, he is thinking, boy, in just a minute now, the king's going to call the other princes in and they're going to do this for me. But it just so happened that the king said to Haman, take quickly the robes and the horse, as you have said, and do so for Mordecai, the Jew, who is sitting at the king's gate. Do not fall short in anything that you have said. Man, that was a good idea. Get it done. And so Haman goes out and does just that, probably somewhat begrudgingly, carries out the command of the king for Mordecai, his despised enemy, that pestilent thorn in his side. And after doing his duty and carrying out his instruction, which for him must have been one of the most repulsive things that he could have been instructed to do, he barely has time to rush home and cry to his wife about the terrible things that have happened to him before he's whisked away again to the palace for the private banquet with the king and queen. And just when things couldn't get any worse for Haman, it just so happened that the king said to Esther on the second day also, as they drank their wine at the banquet, what is your petition, Queen Esther? It shall be granted you. And what is your request? Even to half the kingdom it shall be done. And the Queen Esther replied, if I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it pleases the king, let my life be given me as my petition and my people as my request, for we have been sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. Now, if we had been sold as slaves, men and women, I would have remained silent, for the trouble would not have been commensurate with the annoyance to the king. And King Ahasuerus asked Queen Esther, who is he and where is he who would presume to do thus? And Esther said, a foe and an enemy, this wicked Haman. And Haman became terrified before the king and the queen. And Xerxes, understand, he is ticked right now. He's so frustrated, he leaves the banquet hall and he goes out in the garden, probably to collect his thoughts and figure out, what am I going to do? Because now this number two guy in my kingdom is trying to destroy my wife, and how am I going to handle this? He's frustrated, he's upset. And Haman sees it as an opportunity to prostrate himself before the queen and beg and plead for his life. But it just so happened that when the king returned from the palace garden into the place where they were drinking wine, Haman was falling on the couch where Esther was, and the king said, will he even assault the queen with me in the house? And as the word went out of the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face. And it just so happened that Harbona, one of the eunuchs who were before the king, said, behold, indeed, the gallows standing at Haman's house, 50 cubits high, which Haman made for Mordecai, who spoke good on behalf of the king. And the king said, hang him on it. And so they hanged Haman on the gallows, which he had prepared for Mordecai, and the king's anger subsided. And of course, the rest of the story is that Haman's possessions were all given to Esther. Mordecai was promoted to the position that Haman had, second only under the king. And an edict was issued allowing for all the Jews to defend themselves against any and all of their enemies on the day that was supposed to be the day of their slaughter. And it just so happened in the 12th month, on the 13th day of the month, when the king's command and edict were about to be executed, on the day when the enemies of the Jews hoped to gain the mastery over them, it was turned to the contrary, so that the Jews themselves gained the mastery over those who hated them. It just so happened. I don't believe that for a second. It wasn't chance. It wasn't coincidence. that all of these pieces fell into place just exactly as they did to bring about this great deliverance of the Jewish people. It was God, never mentioned in the narrative, working providentially behind the scenes to make sure that his plans are not overthrown and that his purpose will be established and carried out. And guys, when we look around in our lives today, I would suggest to you it's the same thing. It's not coincidence or chance. It's God's providence. He is working in and around our lives today. I was thinking back just over the last couple of weeks and months and all the times where I think God has providentially been working in my life and those around me. I don't think it was a chance that Rick and Debbie Willis were here when we had a congregational meeting in which I talked about the fact that I'm going to be losing some support next year. Because Richard came to me afterward and said, I want you to contact our church because we're probably in a position where we can help you. Just on Wednesday night, as we were sitting out here during our singing and devotion, Stephanie was praying about bringing up this important topic to discuss with the young ladies in class and asking God that it would go smoothly. And she gets into class, and before she can even bring up the topic, Brianna brings up the topic. That wasn't chance. That's the providence of God. Don, how many times have I preached a lesson and you have picked out songs that go perfectly with the theme and the topic? More than I can remember. I don't think that's chance. I think that's God's providence. I even think about Kevin and Ruby's experience on their bike race. Ruby's air mattress deflated, and they had to leave the race early. They had to be picked up. They couldn't finish. You know what they avoided was that incredibly treacherously steep hill at the end of that race. Was God providentially watching out for them? I think about even last weekend, the coaches for the football team, people bailed. And so the coach is making some phone calls and texting some dads. Can you come help? Turns out Justin and I show up there to help. We spent probably a good two and a half hours together. Yeah, we were handing out some football equipment, but man, we got to catch up and we had some great conversation. And I went away from that spiritually edified. I think that's the providence of God at work in our lives. You could probably come up with some other examples in your own life. But the point that I'm trying to make is this, is that God is working all around us today. He's working in my life and he is working in your life too. That's because he is interested and concerned about his creation. He loves you and he is calling you to be with him. And the question is not really, will you be open to his calling? The question really is, will you respond to his call and come to him?